Hi, this is Fabi Fab.
And this is Babelito.
And we are
Latinos for Lunch, the podcast where we talk about important things like
a la gran diabla mucha. Hello, hello, hello.
Que show.
Here we are, yet again, Latinos Who Lunch, on the airwaves. Hello.
¿Qué tal, amiga? ¿Cómo está?
You know, I'm just here living my best life. How about you?
Same here, getting ready for a crazy couple of weeks of traveling, but looking forward to being on the West Coast for a couple of days, gonna get to see my family, and you know, my dad is gonna come to visit me in California, because I'm going to be there for like 2 days. And I already told them, I need a discada. So, you know, you best believe
wow.
He's going to bring that shit.
Oh, yeah. That's when they get like a hubcap and flip it around and put a bunch of meat in it.
My dad's discada. For anybody who doesn't know who a discada is, like Google it. But my dad's discada is basically el disco es como un wok. But it's thick, right? And you just put it outside con un, you know, like with a burner. Ay, se me está haciendo agua la boca and I haven't even started talking about food. Y mi papá le pone todo. Le pone tocino, luego sale con la grasa del tocino, luego le pone chorizo, y luego le pone carne, y luego le pone vegetales, chile, tomate, cebolla, and then he adds beer. He adds like 3 beers and a couple of shots of tequila. And he lets that shit marinate for like 3 hours. By the time you eat it, it's almost like you're eating chorizo because it's just like all the juices and all the meat starting to disintegrate just at the perfect moment.
Yeah.
Hijo de su madre.
It's like all the things that people like, you know, like crazy diet culture people that like use the napkin to pat off the grease. That always cracks me up when people think when they're eating a slice of pizza and they like pat the grease off of the pizza. I'm like, bitch, you're still going to eat that slice of pizza. Just enjoy it. Enjoy the grease. Like, what right? are you doing? But the discada is like that grease. That's what you're eating. It's so good.
Pero and then para agregarle, to add salt to the wound, you use that grease, and that's how you fry the tortillas.
Oh, bitch. See? Uh-huh. Oh, my God. Well, I don't know about that because I'm a vegan, but I know it smells so good when you guys are doing it. It's so nice. My favorite is the little, you guys always chop up all the little things so you can put like rábano and like all that shit on there. So good.
Dude, but it's become almost like a rite of passage because it's for the dudes, right? So, like, I don't know how to make that shit. But my sister's...
Porque eres una... Because you're a lady and
porque
you want
soy
to
una
remain.
Cualquiera, wey. Porque... So,
ay,
I don't know
esta
how to...
Tipa.
Pero, like, my brother-in-law is the one who, like, le pasaron la torcha a él. So, like, in the family... Only...
Is that really the word, torcha? I feel like that's a Spanglish word.
No, la torcha. La torcha torta, encendida. That's... There was even a soap opera in the 90s called La Torcha Encendida. So, maybe it's
but
Latin.
Say it like a soap opera star.
La Torcha Encendida.
I'm watching that.
Not so boring. It's about 19th century Mexican history. Because in the 90s...
Isn't every novella about that? What are you talking about?
Every novella is about 18th century fucked up Mexican history. But anyway, that's what's going on with me. What's going on with you?
Oh, bitch. We got to talk about what we've been eating. Because, you know, I've been really inspired by... the junk food that I eat, a lot of my work is about that.
Right.
And about, I just been thinking about food a lot lately, ever since last year when I did that show about Tex-Mex food, you know?
Yes.
And so I'm always thinking about like the botanas that we eat and like Doritos, for example, and how they're like kind of like tortilla chips, like Mexican, but they have their own... It's like this really weird identity that Doritos have. They're like masculine chips, kind of.
Are
you know?
They?
I feel like Doritos are very masculine. Like it's always like a lightning bolt and like Doritos crunch.
Oh,
you know
true,
what I mean?
True, I guess. Yeah.
And so, like always bright colors. There's only one bag that's like pink, which I mean, I know that doesn't mean masculine, feminine, but and it's like the one that's like I think it's a like a variety thing. I don't know. Anyway, you know how they make those like prefabbed, not fab, pre-mixed botana bags? Like you can, like it's for, let's be honest, it's for all you high ass motherfuckers that are like, I want to eat right. hot Cheetos and pretzels and Doritos at the same time. Like, oh my God, get a life. But guess what? I started making my own. So my favorite is to get regular Doritos, oof. Okay? Latinos for Lunch, sponsored by Frito-Lay. And then get, so regular Doritos, but just a little bit, just to pay homage to the godfather of chips, okay? And then my favorite potato chips are actually Ruffles.
Rufles, como decimos en
yes,
México.
Yes, Rufles. Please decolonize our Ruffles. And so Rufles and regular Rufles are the best because you can put like Valentina on them and shit. Oh, right. They're so bomb. A little limon. But for this mix, I'm trying to go like all the way. I'm trying to like high blood pressure all the way to the hospital with this. So I got to get the sour cream and cheddar Rufles, okay? Then,
oh my God.
So I put that in a bowl. Then I put in hot Cheetos. I sprinkle hot Cheetos on top of that. Then,
uh-huh. Oh my God.
See? It must. And then I do regular Ruffles, okay, on top of that, the white ones. And then I put more hot Cheetos on top of that. And then that's when I put in the Takis. Not the spicy Takis.
Because there are other kinds, bitch. That shit is always on fire.
Nah, girl. My new favorite are the barbecue ones. They're kind of spicy. They're like in a blue bag. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, actually, you would really like this because you like to eat like ketchup and sugar and all the bullshit you eat.
Yes,
you'd
I like do. Them. I would love
them. And so, because they remind me of the barbacoa tortrix, those are the Guatemalan chips. They remind me of
tortrix?
Them.
Tortrix?
Yeah, they're called tortrix. Those are the chips that they sell in Guatemala. I don't know why you're laughing. That's very disrespectful to Central American culture. I don't appreciate this Mexico-centric hate that I hear coming from the microphone. But yeah, they're called tortrix. I explained it to you. I explained tortrix. It's not, you know what? Stay woke, Babalito. I told you about tortrix on the Guatemala episode we did earlier last year.
Okay.
So I like to mix all those together and I eat them. And it's like the perfect pairing with like a shitty soda. And so I'm not saying all that to say that I just ate that with a Diet Coke and I feel like absolute trash. So
it's like it gives you a high for like 10 minutes and luego ya te sientes como mierda.
It felt so good eating it because it's like, ooh, spicy, ooh, crunchy. I love those textures. But now I feel like I'm absolute shit.
Es como cuando comes tostilocos.
Yeah, and you know, and I am always just like, excuse my caucasity for using this term, but I'm always flabbergasted at the amount of sodium in like the amount of salt in like Latino treats, like in yes. like botanas. Like, okay, yeah, let me get a what do they fucking call those, the mangonadas with like all of the fucking tajin on it?
Yeah,
I don't remember. You know what it's called when they like when you go to a malicón or malecón, how do you say it? I don't know, maricón. and you get like the cup of like cueritos with like cacahuates japoneses, and then they put in like a pulparindo straw, and then they put in, what is that called?
I don't know, but I know exactly where
you're
talking about.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes. Y le ponen los cachitos like, de tamarindo con chile. That's what the tostilocos are, but with papitas, yeah. It's supposed to like cueritos.
And so, oh my God. It's so good. Hold on. My tia is here. Oh, so fucking annoying. It's because I'm staying at my grandma's house, so they just show up. You can leave this in if you want. Give me 1 second. I got to tell her to stop ringing the doorbell like, damn. Oh, sorry.
I'm on!
That's how I talk to my family.
And we're back.
And we're back. Oh, I don't think you got me cussing out my aunt on there because I was... No, I'm just kidding.
No, I didn't. I didn't. I took it out.
Thanks. Okay, what was I talking about?
De los cueritos con el chile, los cacahuates japoneses. I don't know what makes him Japanese except for like the racist ass fucking rapping.
I think it's made up. I think it's like a fortune cookies aren't really Chinese, you know, kind of thing.
Okay.
They were invented in San Francisco in Chinatown.
Right, like el sushi.
Yeah.
Okay, like el California roll.
Yes, I think that was invented in California. You're right.
Something. But anyway, what about the cueritos? Cueritos?
No, I'm just saying, like, that's the kind of snacks that we have.
No, and all the fucking sodium, that's what you were saying. And it's true, like, when you think of, I never think about tajin, but you're right. Like, and when I eat pineapple, and not pineapple, sandia on the summer, I fucking load it with that shit. But one day I look at the bottle and I was like, Diosito Santo, it's insane. Wait, cuando me como esas madres, yo nunca usaba, like, I never used rings before till now with my wedding ring. Se me atora
okay,
el anillo.
Brag, we get it, you're married.
No,
oh
bitch, pero se me atora el pinche anillo en el dedo porque así me hincho, güey. Like, I get wow. So puffy with that shit.
Mm-hmm. Wow, wow, wow. You're eating a lot of salt, that's great. Wow. I know, it's too much. And you think Mexicans are bad with sodium? Guatemalans? Oh my God. Like,
¿neta?
The amount of salt. Neta del planeta, güey. Like, when we cook, we like salt. We season and salt the shit out of everything. My family does anyway. And I feel like it's the same worldwide. But like, I feel like, yeah, because my Mexican family are like, oh my God, you put a lot of... I'm like, oh, I thought this was like the normal amount of salt. But I don't know. It's a lot. I have to watch it.
No. Okay, let's start then. But anyway, so we are here because we have a special interview. We always say special interview because all our interviews are special. With a badass artist, Sandy Rodriguez. And I wanted to talk a little bit about a couple of things before we start, before we go into that recording, because we... nerd it out. I have rarely talked about colonial shit like that in the podcast before, so we just like started talking about all this shit, and I was listening to the interview, and I was just like, you know what, let me break down some of the things that we talked about, and then we'll listen to the interview, and there's like more questions and other things that de que se nos ocurran that we can come back after the interview and get into it. But one of the first things that we talked about, and we didn't get into it in detail, is the Florentine Codex. And
yeah, what is that?
So the Florentine Codex is pretty much one of the two or three surviving documents that we have about pre-conquest in central Mexico. So pre-conquest Nahuatl traditions, Mexica traditions. And also it's an account, one of the few indigenous accounts of the conquest. In Mexico, we have that. We have the Lienzo de Tlaxcala and a couple of things. But most of that shit got erased, you know? And there was no time because there's a genocide happened outside, so a lot of people couldn't record everything that what was going on at that time. So this was, of course, was commissioned by a religious person, a Franciscan, a Spanish person. So you have to take that shit with a grain of salt. So what we talk about is that we talk about the history of how that book came to be, because it was 30 years of research of different people talking about different traditions and la comida y lo que se vestían, las plantas, like everything about the Nahuatl world is recorded there. So that's what we referred to when we talked about Bernardino de Sahagún is the Franciscan who commissioned that. And the Florentine Codex is named after the Florentine Library where it's at in France. Because a lot of that shit, a lot of those things became like trophies of war. So instead of staying in Mexico, they went back to Europe, and then they were given away by the Spanish kings, sort of like, look, we conquered this and we are badasses, so here is el penacho de Moctezuma, or here is this, that, and or this book, you know. So they became trophies of war. And but again, still today, that's like pretty much the only information we have about a lot of things pertaining the Aztec world, you know, the Nahuatl world.
Okay.
So her art is based on that. A lot of research and a lot of the materials, it comes from that document. And also, when we talk about las relaciones geográficas, is something also that I want to do a whole episode just on that, bitch, because it's so interesting. So the relaciones geográficas, it's also around that period. This was commissioned by Philip II, the king of Spain, towards the end of the 16th century, middle 8th, 16th century. And, you know, we have our idea of a map, right? A map is like a bird's eye view. You see the territory, the ocean, and there's like lines and all kinds of names and all kinds of shit. It's a very European way to see things. It's like, I look at this and I possess this shit, you know? So like everything that when we think about maps, including Google Maps, is based on that. And when you see those close-ups, those 3D close-ups of maps in Google, that was a creation of the Romans. Like, that's been around for like 2,000 years. So with that in mind, Philip II is telling everybody who now owns properties in Mexico, he basically said, everybody in a different territory of central Mexico has to make me a map because I want to know all the territory that we have. But because people have a different relationship with land, the maps look different. So it doesn't look, it's not like bird's eye view. So some of them are round. It looks like a big circle. Some of them look like spiral. That's because everybody's relationship and movement within the land is different. So by the time they put all the maps together of the relaciones geográficas and were brought back to Philip II, he's like, what the fuck is this? Like, how can I use that? That is a form of resistance. So that's another thing that we talked about. We also mentioned the Bourbons, and that's just the family that was in power by the 1700s. So there's like a couple details here and there, and a lot of like historical details that we didn't get into it, but the most important one is relaciones geográficas, because it's about non-European type of understanding the land through maps, and also the Florentine Codex. So I just wanted to like, you know, break that down, and then we can get into the interview.
All right. I hope y'all were taking notes.
Do it.
Pull over. Pull your car over. Take some notes.
But before we go into the interview, why don't we go into a short commercial, and then we'll get to listen to Sandy Rodriguez.
Babalito, my word. It is so nice to see so many people helping us out on our Patreon and PayPal.
And yes, thank you everybody who's been supporting and donating. It means the world to us, and without your help, we will not be able to do this. But remember that if you want to join our groups in Patreon, we have three levels. The first level, you can donate $1, you get a shout out, and that's our Amiga level.
That's right, and for $3, you get to be our comadre. So join for $3, be our comadre, and you get extra perks. Go on latinoswholunch.com/donate, and you can click on the Patreon link to see all the perks you get.
And the final level, the for $10, you can become our madrina, and you get all of the above, the shout out, the special bonus episodes, and on top of that, we will send you some Latinos Who Lunch stickers. So again, for $1, join our amiga level, for $3, you join our comadre level, and for $10, you join our madrina level.
That's right, and I'm gonna actually start, I think, sending stuff out since I have your addresses now. First of all, I'm going to go on Zillow.com and see how much your house is worth. And then I'll decide what I'm going to send you. Just kidding. I don't do that kind of stuff. It always cracks me up when people email me like, hey, Favi, I'm a big fan. Like, I haven't been stalking them on Instagram like for the past 2 years. Shout out to Ed. So I... listen, if you want me to send you weird stuff, put your address, make sure you put your address, madrinas, in the Patreon form so that I can actually send you those perks, because we're developing merch or like fun things, and I want to make sure to send them to you first so you guys can show them off, okay? And that's the perks of being a madrina. You're like family. So again, like Olive Garden, we treat you like family. God damn, this commercial is a goddamn mess. Please.
Out of control.
Please visit us, latinoswholunch.com/donate, or go over to patreon.com/latinoswholunch.
Que show, Babelito here, recording from LA, Inglewood, California.
Mar Vista.
And I am here in the presence of one of my favorite artists right now. I'm really excited. Sandy Rodriguez, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This is absolutely a thrill.
Okay, so I'm nervous and excited, but I'm going to tell you a little bit of the story behind how I met Sandy. So right after my wedding, this was in December 15, we spent a couple of weeks with my in-laws in Riverside, in San Bernardino. And we were just looking for things to do, so we decided to go to the art museum. And we heard about this exhibition that took information from the Florentine Codex. And I was like, oh, this is gonna be cool. Let's go watch it. Y miren, entré a la galería y caí en un abismo de pasión. It was such a good show. And I remember talking to my husband and saying, you know what? I have to get her information. I need to talk to her. This is too good. And I went back to Chicago and sent you an email. And I said, I want you in my podcast. And then when she replied, yes, I know Latinos Who Lunch, casi me cago away. I was so, 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 so excited. So this has been in the works for a whole year.
Exactly.
And it's finally happening. Again, thank you so much for having us in your studio. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this short interview. ¿Cómo estás?
I am fantastic. I am so excited to have you here and to have you be able to preview the newest work of the Codex Rodriguez Mondragón series, and to just kind of share some of the process and stories behind everything with you.
So tell our audience, what do you do? What is your, you do a lot, right? but what is the main idea behind some of your pieces? Tell us a little bit about the material, because this is very fascinating.
So what I'm doing is creating a series of maps, portraits now, and studies of both locations, endemic flora, fauna, and now people to the Americas, and really using the materials that have been used traditionally in this region to tell our stories. So I'm really working with contemporary politics, moments of the conquest, finding cycles and histories that intersect with a variety of subject areas.
Right. And the materials that you use, where did that inspiration come from?
So having had a background in working in museums and working in museum education, I was very familiar over the course of 20 years mm-hmm. with Western European art history and materials.
Yes. The canon.
Oh, yes. And so as I became more familiar with colorants that were specific to the Americas. And cochinilla, nochesli, cochineal uh-huh. being kind of the gateway colorant for understanding how the global art market and global trade was influenced by colorants of the Americas, that led me to a text called Colors of the New World by Diana Magaloni.
Right, which you and I are like fans.
I have absolutely been obsessed with this text, the author, and all the related material for the past 3 years.
Right.
So in that text, she describes how Book 11 of the Florentine Codex mm-hmm. is a painting treatise of the Nahual world in the 16th century. My investigation started there with understanding that there is a codification, a conceptual basis for mm-hmm. using earth materials right. versus solar realm plant-based materials.
Oh, wow.
So I'm really playing with this idea of conceptual contemporary practice rooted in a tradition of my history, my people, my region.
Right.
I'm 3 generations painter, and uh-huh. so really kind of playing with colorants that are hand-foraged, processed, and impregnating the surface of a sacred ceremonial outlawed paper, amate, uh-huh. to tell this story is critical for me.
See, this is fascinating. And for those of for those that might be unfamiliar, cochinilla transformed the world. Cochinilla, it's a bug that you get from el nopal, and it dries. And when it dries, you smash it, and you get the brightest red, right?
The most beautiful red in the world.
So when the Spanish arrived, they're like, cha-ching, So they brought it back to the new world. I mean, to the new world. Don't use that word. They brought it back to Europe. And it transformed the empire. It completely transformed the empire because now you can get all of these pigments from bugs, from plants, as opposed to like semi-precious stones. And there was like this big demand. And now that I think about it, one of the things that Magaloni talks about in the Florentine Codex, which is, it's almost like an encyclopedic book of everything from the Nahuatl world, right? It was based on Pliny's Roman, like the history of Rome. And I remember in the text of Magaloni, she talks about at some point, everything is in black and white because the demand for these pigments was such, and the extermination of native peoples in central Mexico was such that the people that were creating the panecillos, those tortillas that you could buy, that you could actually extract the color from, were dead. They were completely gone. So there's like a whole history of these practices in the Americas, but yet when we go to school, we learn the same fucking thing, right?
Yeah, so the 24 tlacuilojes that are working in the Colegio de Tlatelolco mm-hmm. in Santa Cruz, by the time they hit book 11, and once they start describing the chapter on color, is when the peste is so tremendous that they can't go outside and harvest anything. They can't collect any colorants from anyone. So even the chapter on color and then the entire book 12 of the Conquest is in black and white. So there's a way of describing color through different kinds of visual elements.
Signifiers, yeah.
So if there's a particular bottle brush plant that's bright red, they put a little ladybug next to
right,
it.
Right, right, right. I was just explaining that to my suegros because we were talking about your art and we were talking about what we were going to do. And I was explaining the Florentine colors. So I'm like, le ponen una vaquita because that's what Mexicans call it, like a little vaquita. Because that was a signifier for red.
Yeah, and so like by the time you get to book 12 of the Conquest, which is the only narrative told from the indigenous perspective of the Conquest,
right.
There's still a couple folios, or not folios, but miniatures that have a little bit of Maya green and a little bit of Maya blue. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I thought they were completely out. No, they were saving it to highlight certain geographical locations where these scenes took place.
Right.
You know, and so in dealing with the map that I described to you of Los Angeles, I had to really think very strategically about what was going to be heightened. If I'm trying to make the parallels from Conquest to caging,
right,
really jumping off from that, how do you in a very restrained way use color, you know?
Yeah, so why maps of Los Angeles? Why maps of California? Are you from this area?
I'm from the border.
Okay.
So I was born in National City, grew up on both sides of the border in Tijuana mm-hmm. and San Diego, moved 13 times before I ended in Los Angeles in 1987.
Oh, wow.
So I consider the border in the southern part of California and the Southwest to be home.
Right. And how long have you been working with doing these types of maps?
So this is now starting the third year
uh-huh.
of this series. And so while the first map was really my explorations into the various floristic provinces of California to understand which colors from the Florentine are available in the Sonoran Desert, right. the Mojave Desert, to the Great Basin
That's
Desert,
amazing.
And camped out 5 to 7 days each time under the full moon with bright, bright, gorgeous light and the sounds of the coyotes and the smell of everything. Bringing in all my water, campfires every night, working with all these herbalists and different people than art people.
¿Y te vas sola?
No, me voy con un herbalist y un grupo de gente.
Oh, nice, nice, nice.
You know, especially for these first field studies. So mm-hmm. the first map was about plotting the natural resources wow. that had been used as medicine and as color. And so by the time I finished that map, it became crystal clear that I couldn't ignore the detention centers that peppered the California landscape.
Fuck.
And so really understanding that the criminalization of our people and our history was not known, it became this moment to really kind of collapse time from the colonial to the present
right.
and really make that crystal clear in a document that could then be performed to kind of teach about a contemporary history and an earlier history that we're all a part of, but that's not appreciated.
Right. So just to describe a map of Sandy Rodriguez, you will have a map that shows part of the West Coast of the United States, highlighting but at the same time subverting some of the border area. Sometimes maps highlight the border of New Spain right before independence in 1810. So that includes Nevada, Utah, California, Texas, et cetera, et cetera. And imagine a bird's eye view of a map of California, but inserted within maps are little signifiers of what you're saying, of clashing time, of collapsing time. So you see helicopters of ICE agents. You have markers where some of these cages where they incarcerate our children at. And then at the same time, you have sea creatures. You also have a variety of things that all of them have a source, a historical document source. That's what I was fascinated about, because I am an art historian and I have a lot of kids working with me, and I have a few artists, and I'm always pushing them to do research-based art. So when I saw your art, I was just like, oh my God, this is exactly what I'm... This is. So I show it to my students. Oh, by the way, I want to invite you to give a lecture in my class, but we'll talk about it later.
Oh my God, I can't wait.
But anyway, explain a little bit of that, of your attraction to at every single turn in your work, there's a reference to a historical document.
So as I mentioned before, I had a long background in supporting my art practice by mm-hmm. teaching in museums mm-hmm. and teaching with historic collections. So every single element has a source. Every single element has a reference to. Be,
right.
Nothing is a pure invention. Everything is retold from another time or place and is a reference in upholding something bigger. Mm-hmm. So in creating these works, being very much aware of these traditions, it became an opportunity and a responsibility to really thoughtfully pluck elements from different texts, mm-hmm. but primarily from the Florentine, to populate it with what we've known for 500 years
right.
as our history and our culture, you know? So like every sea creature that you see in the ocean is a direct quote from the Florentine Book 11. Mm. Every plant I found in the wilderness and cross-referenced it with something from Book 11 or another ethnographic source. So I'm cross-referencing all of this with ethnobotany from a database out of University of Michigan, with the Florentine, with contemporary botany databases out of Berkeley, and really getting to what do we know about these plants in 2019 or 2018 or 2017?
Antes de que se extingan.
And what did we know about it 500 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And how are we kind of understanding the uses of living things around us that are part of us in this location?
And what is fascinating about this, your projects, but also this process, it's that the processes themselves of going out and quote-unquote exploring have this very oppressive history, right? So like the first botanists, in a way, were the Franciscans, who are just surveying everything. But the purposes of the Franciscans was extermination, was control, and was power, was land possession. And then we have a second wave of that in the late 1700s with the Bourbons, because they were obsessed about classifying everything from insects to humans. The French, don't get me started. And you're doing some of those practices, but for a completely different end. And that's what I find fascinating. When we were driving over here, I told my husband, what I like about those maps is that you're surveilling the surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fantastic.
And really thinking about how you use these conventions of cataloging for different purposes.
Exactly.
For my purposes.
Right. And the purposes. And this is what we refer to in the podcast now as an anti-colonial gesture, as opposed to decolonizing practices, because everything is so colonial, it's impossible to decolonize. But this is the perfect example of a decolonial gesture that is taking those practices that are embedded in our ways of understanding the world, because we understand maps, all of us understand maps the same way, and kind of trying to change that, it's almost utopic. But there's still things, anti-colonial things that you can do with those practices that have been around for so long. So looking at maps and looking at all those identifiers and signifiers, it's exactly what I'm talking about. It's an anti-colonial gesture.
And really kind of looking at a variety of mapping from the indigenous perspective, right, as opposed to the European perspectives of mapping from this particular period, is something I get to play with and collapse and turn on its head and experiment with. So every map uses different strategies.
Right.
The first one was a complete aerial with a few kind of landscapes kind of juxtaposed right within these floristic kinds of provinces. The second map had more combination of both those, but then also these like Google map kind of aerial views of, wow, the detention centers. So it becomes this lived media and then historic.
Love it.
The third map becomes this more kind of elevations of the transverse range, because I'm doing Los Angeles for the first time.
Right.
This is home.
And yes, that's your lived experience.
This is my lived experience since, mm-hmm, 1987. You know, mm-hmm, but when did it finally take me, or when did the opportunity finally arise for me to go into the foothills of the San Gabriels and into,
right,
all of the Santa Monica Range and really slow down? In the same way as we look at art and we slow down and we inventory and we look very closely and we really kind of make associations, there's a way of looking at the natural world, mm-hmm, that has a very clear parallel for me for looking at art.
Right.
So it's interesting that depending on how much time I've spent in a place, mm-hmm, it'll change the way that I depict the place.
And this reminds me a lot of another 16th century project, the Las Relaciones Geográficas.
Uh-huh.
And Las Relaciones Geográficas was this empire project gone wrong for the best way. So basically, Philip II, he's like, okay, girl, we need to inventory everything that I own now. So everybody that has properties in New Spain, at least in central Mexico, they all have to make a map for me. So they go to all the people that in a way own those lands, and they, in return, commission indigenous people from the area to make maps. But everybody understands mapping and understands a relationship with their land in a different way. So the idea was to have a CEO of like 200 maps put together into a book. So he could show basically all the different areas. And the result was like, I don't know, like 60 or so different maps. They all look different because everybody has a different relationship. I think it's Alessandra Russo. He calls it circular realism, the idea of walking around the land. And they understand that by walking. So they have different perspectives. They collapse time. They collapse space. And they are fascinating. So I also recognize that too when I saw your pieces, that you are not only just looking at one way of understanding, because maps as we know it today, it's such a colonial thing, right?
Oh, yeah.
Gazing possession, but there's so much more to it.
And then last February, when I was invited up to Berkeley,
mm-hmm,
I got to go into special collections and they pulled all of these objects for me, including the diseños.
Híjole.
And so now I'm looking at full color diseños,
uh-huh,
with these amazing squiggly lines to describe the oaks and little bears like with their tongues out, like by this tree, by a, uh-huh, stream. And it's got A, B, C, and D. And you know there's a key to it, uh-huh, to understand that my property is from this stream by this tree where the bears hang out to over here by this, you know, hill and mountain, this landmarker.
Right.
And so I became very much aware of the diseño maps. And those are all attached to the land grant cases after the 1848 kind of acquisition of this territory.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking about the role of maps to defend what is your,
correct,
family's livelihood in concert with the relaciones, in concert with some of these earlier maps. And so really kind of playing with this idea of place and how you know place, mm-hmm, and how you represent place became something really important for me to think about with these new landscapes. So I purposefully in these new landscapes have pulled out, and they're like 31 inches by 47 inches,
mm-hmm,
a lot of the visual vocabulary from the diseños that I thought was really familiar when I arrived into this area near Nogales that I hope is legible.
Right.
You know, and I know in one of the texts, it's another piece, not that one. I reference the diseños that are in that collection.
It's so amazing. So now tell us a little bit about this new project that you're about to unveil.
So this new exhibition is called You Will Not Be Forgotten. It is 19 portraits, a map, and folios about the seven Central American migrant children that were killed in Customs Border Enforcement custody. Mm-hmm. So in addition to their portraits that are painted on 22 by 15 inch folios of a brown amate, which is different than the mixed amate that I've been working on, this is the exterior bark of a wild fig that is harvested. It's then simmered in a lye solution, pounded with volcanic rock, and laid to dry in the sun. This particular amate has clay from Puebla embedded into the tissue of the amate. So it almost looks like flesh. So these portraits are done of the seven children with the year of their birth, the year of their death, their names, and they're thoroughly researched. Those have companions of the medicinal plants that are used in a recipe to treat trauma or susto.
And this recipe is from the 16th century, right?
This recipe is written in the 16th century by a physician who survived both the conquest and the plague.
Damn.
And so this recipe has a number of ingredients, and so I'm mapping both the locations of where they died, but also offering up the remedio for trauma that they sustained, that we are sustaining by living through this particular moment. In addition to the maps and the child portraits, you have a selection of healers that are processing remedios or recipes for treating the flu, for treating certain health issues that eventually kill these kids. And so I've taken scholars and folks that I've been in conversation with, and I've replaced the images of the healers with their portraits and really created an opportunity for us to both humanize the children who have been killed, but also to think about the traditions of healing and care and protection that we have in our cultural history.
And that's, we were just talking about this, and I was just mentioning how we tend to forget these children have humanity, that they're human beings, because they are the signifier, or they're the body. I mean, we basically put all of the weight of the fucked up immigration system onto them when they just want to play, right? They just want to be, children. And, I learned this from my advisor, Kirsten Bue, and she talks about how there's a difference between children and childhood. Childhood are adult fantasies of what children are. And it's important to see this, that they have humanity, they have faces, they have stories. And what I find really interesting about your work is that you address these issues, but you're very, very conscious about the material. Like, the material and the actual portrait, there's a lot of there's like a big relationship between both of them. And that's something, it's carried throughout all of your work, but it seems to have a significant importance on this project.
Yeah, I mean, in reading all of the news stories in English, then reading all of the news stories in Spanish, then reading all of the foreign press, and then the testimonies of the parents of the kids, you have a crystal clear vision of them as people.
Right.
You know, Felipe is 7 years old. He's the one that died on Christmas Eve.
Right.
After sleeping on the floor underneath the freeway in El Paso.
Wow.
With no blankets. Marie was healthy. She was 1 year old. But after being in a jaula in the hielera for an extended amount of time with sick kids, develops a respiratory issue. She gets no treatment. She dies in the hospital.
Right.
You know, every single one of them have an extraordinary story that is just you know, tallied up as the sixth child migrant to die. No, they didn't just die.
Yeah.
You know? And so to humanize them and to not traumatize ourselves, their memory or their families or our community, it was a very, very difficult dance between how do I respectfully present the story,
right,
and how do I honor this moment in a way that will keep the conversation alive despite whatever shit is in the media.
And this ties to our interview with Annette, because she talks about how many times when we have this war crimes, because that's what they are, when we have this when the empire strikes in such a way, the news and the ideas to focus on the parents. What did the parents do? Why do they have to migrate, right? As opposed to say, no, like, it doesn't matter where they come from. It doesn't matter what they did. What matters is what happened, right? And that's something that sometimes gets sensacionalizado because, you know, we love to empathize for the wrong reasons. But at all turns, their stories and their humanity, even though it's in the intersection of all these conversations, we glaze over it. Yeah. We completely forget about it. And that's what's fascinating about your project, that so thoughtful and so specific about the relationship between the material and the biography and the story behind what happened, and also connecting it to this material also makes it something that it's been happening for 500 years, right? And also linking it to what's happening today. It's amazing.
And I'll tell you that I work with a group of writers and we call ourselves Project 1521. Mm-hmm. And just before the holiday break, I invited them, and we meet once a quarter in the studio, mm-hmm. to look at the work, to hear about the research, and then to respond in the form of a variety of voices. There will be a reading at the closing of the exhibition. The exhibition opens at Charlie James Gallery in Chinatown here in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. January 25th. And the show will run through mid-March. But we're doing a performance on the final, I think it's February 22nd. It'll mm-hmm. be all on the website. Mm-hmm. But we'll have readings of text that was created for these kids, for these objects, and to activate and perform this particular exhibition through the voices of 10 different writers.
So this is now, your 2019 was busy, eye twitching busy. What's next? What's next for Sandy Rodriguez?
Oh, well, wonderful things. I was just awarded a 7-week artist residency, but I can't talk about it yet till the announcement comes out. But that begins in April.
Oh, wow. Nice.
And then in April, I was also invited to come to Yale to do some research in the Beinecke Rare Books Collection to look at the map.
Wow.
And give a few talks. So I'll be doing some East Coast research and some artist talks, and then going into a 7-week residency.
That's wonderful.
So I'm pretty much booked up through late June.
That's blessings. You know, a todos los art, like colonial art historians, nos traes locos, güey. Because we never get any artists that do and understand what we do. And this is something I talked about in an essay I wrote, that the empire and the nation works in the ways that you're supposed to be, not grateful, but pride of your pre-Columbian past or your modern history. Y todo lo colonial vale madre, güey. Even though we are part, I mean, we hate it, but we're part of this system, right? So when I found out about you, I was like, I'm going to write about Sandy Rodriguez. And then I found out that everybody else was writing about Sandy Rodriguez. My colleagues were writing about Sandy Rodriguez. Shout out to Ananda Cohen, who's an amazing scholar in Cornell. And she also listens to the podcast. So shout out to you, girl. And we talked about you. We were like nerding out. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to go meet her. Oh, no, no way. I'm writing an essay about her. I'm like, what? You already wrote an essay about her? So it's like a thing. So, and also like the fact that you work closely not only with your research but people that have done research with this, it's amazing. There's very few artists, if so, that are doing this.
No, I am so incredibly in awe and inspired every single time I get my hands on a new article or get to go to a conference and just get spoon fed all the scholarship and be like, I love you, not you so much, but I love you. you know, and just to have a chance to really understand what are some new ways of looking at this material that hasn't been presented in a wider way.
And what I like about you is that you take the, which is what I try to do with this podcast, what we try to do with this podcast is that you take the academic and then you bring it to a larger audience. Because sometimes academics, we tend to do circle jerks and nothing happens. You know, we just talk about this shit and then that's it. And then we publish books that only us read. And then we go into fucking parties and then we pretend we're better than everybody else. What's the point? So the idea is that academia is dying and we need to share these forms of knowledge with everybody, not just with our students because we get paid. And to see artists like you, to see people like Nandi, who's also like expanding these ideas to wider audiences, it's very inspiring and it's amazing. So for that, thank you so much.
Oh my God. And I can't tell you how incredibly nourished I am and how amazing it feels to be so openly embraced by a group of scholars that have a different kind of area of focus.
Right.
Like, I've been working with artists and contemporary and historic art history of the canon for so long that to be able to really kind of get down into the weeds with the people who are writing the texts that excite me and to be so generously invited in and offered PDFs and offered new articles and pointed to new resources allows me to go so much more kind of deep with the content that I'm dying to learn more about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, and that's something that it should be like a little bit of a lesson to a lot of artists, because as artists and sometimes as students, we are afraid of what we consider las vacas sagradas. You know, when you have like those scholars that are like all that, and you're like, no, how is he gonna or she gonna answer my email? Just do it.
Well, yeah, and you get scared to death. Yeah. You're like, I'm going to get poo-pooed. I'm like, right. I'm not one of you.
Yeah, and it's like,
I'm just some, like, crazy artist who's, like, asking me all these questions, and why won't she stop?
Right, but the thing is that we're more hungry for this type of content, this type of visual and material culture in our circles and outside of our circles than we think. So if you're doing anything remotely with research-based art or historical documents, just go for it, because we also are like fangirls, and we love to also fangirl with artists, and we're always very thankful that our words go beyond, you know, like a fancy article. But anyway, thank you so much, Sandy.
Oh, really? It's my pleasure.
Again, this has been in the works for a year, and I'm so happy and so thrilled. I go back to Chicago very, very happy. Thank you. Thank you again. Oh, wait. Tell everybody where to find you. If there's anything else you want to plug, your social media, all of it.
So there's a ton of things coming up. I'm going to be updating my website. So go to studiosandyrodriguez.com. And you'll have all of the links for the new catalog, for the upcoming exhibitions, the talks from the West Coast to the East Coast, and all upcoming wonderful things.
Google loca. And your social media.
My Instagram is studio.sandyrodriguez or studiosandyrodriguez.
Ya lo escucharon, cabrones. Apúntelo y póngase a hacer la tarea. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you later. Chao, chao, chao.
Thank you. Toodaloo, toodaloo,
toodaloo, toodaloo. Oh my gosh, I was so into her art. I had to do a deep, deep dive after I listened to this interview, Babalito. Thank you for introducing us to such an amazing artist.
Yeah, the few colonial art historians in this country are crazy about him, about her. She's been in journals, and I got to see that shit a year ago, and it was incredible. The amount of research for every single art piece is fascinating. Like, she, what I liked about that is that it's for example, the first series that she worked on, the maps. That took 3 years. That took 3 years. Wow. Of like camping in the middle of the fucking desert, getting samples of plants, taking those samples and comparing them with samples of Mexico. Like, it fue un pedo tototototote. But the result was this incredible, incredible, incredible body of work that the whole entire
like all the Latino Americanos in academia, they're just like crazy, crazy about her art. So she exploded with those series. So it's nice. It's nice to see this like research-based type of work. So thank you so much, Sandri Rodriguez, for this way overdue interview.
Yeah. And I really liked what you said about circle jerks in the art world and in the academia world. I mean, not mm-hmm. only because they happen every Tuesday at... No, I'm just kidding. But no, but because I guess... I mean, honestly, it's like, what's the point of doing all this research if you're going to keep it in, you know, like, just have an exclusive club of people that know this information? Like, there's got to be a way to share this. And I think... that first of all, like you, for example, being an academic that is aware of that, because let me tell you, a lot of y'all art historians are not aware of how boring and like not a, not like accessible your work is, you know. But to right. celebrate an artist that's making this work visual and like accessible and to see that information processed in such a way is a huge deal. And then for academics like you to actually talk about it and celebrate it and, you know, come up with a new kind of way of talking about the work and or the history and viewing the history, I think that's really, really important, Babs. You're doing, you and Sandy are doing great work.
And this goes with this goes with what we were talking about last time, that we gotta own our successes and we gotta own what we're working on. So now, for example, when I get an interview for anything from a grant, when I'm writing a grant, all the way to getting an interview for a job, I highlight the podcast. I highlight the YouTube series that we're working on, and it's part of the digital humanities, and it's something that a lot of people don't talk about. There's an awesome essay by Paul B. Jascott. It's called Digital Art History and the Social History of Art Towards the Disciplinary Relevance of Digital Methods.
Ooh, this rolls right off
and
the
for
tongue.
Example, and for example, in the last College of Art Association, there was a whole panel just on podcasts and in ways that artists and art historians are using podcasts as a way to take this information outside of academia, because I'm sorry to say it, but academia is fucking dying. So we have to keep up with the times and highlight artists like Sandy and I don't hide it anymore, bitch. I tell my students, this is my podcast and you need to listen to this episode. Like, I send them to listen to the episode of La Virgen de Guadalupe, or if we're talking about the casta system and we don't have enough time, I'm like, go listen to that episode. I don't care anymore. And they actually appreciate, and that's the stuff that sticks to them most. So YouTube videos and podcasts, all of that is becoming the future of academia. So like, people need to change, because otherwise you're gonna publish your book and it's just gonna get dusty in a library. Nothing's gonna happen, you know? So I think it's important to talk about these things.
Future. I'm the future, you tired ass showgirl. Finish that quote.
Eh?
Finish that quote.
Ay, no me la sé, güey.
Oh my God. Come on. Oh, you're killing me, Babs. You're supposed to say, go back to city where you go back to Party City where you belong. Oh my God.
I just know that part of the quote. I don't know the first part.
Wow. That's why I thought, okay, if I set it up for him, maybe he'll impress me here with his improv skills. But
anyway,
you know, we gotta set each other up for success. I'm sorry about that. I apologize.
Anyway, thank you so much to Sandy Rodriguez for this amazing amazing interview. And if you're interested, you Google it. There's all the links that we posted on they're going to be posted on the website. But are there any recommendations coming from you, Favi, before we go?
Well, you know that I'm always listening to podcasts. And oh, since I'm talking about RuPaul's Drag Race, I listen to a lot of RuPaul's Drag Race recap shows, and I really love... I don't think I've ever talked about Drag Her on here. It's a podcast by Mono Agapian and Nicole Byer, and they... Well, Nicole Byer is so fucking busy that she has like 5 podcasts, and sometimes she doesn't show up to the drag one. So Mono has special guests on it, and I really like their take on the show, because I guess Mono is a drag queen sometimes. Like, he does it as for fun. He's a comedian, but he's not a full-time drag queen. So it's the perspective of the show is from fans.
Which is always better.
Yeah, and you know, it's always great because having also like guests that are people of color is also fun, and they really have a diverse set of guests that show up sometimes. So it's fun, and I love to listen to that podcast.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm.
How about you?
So I got two sort of crooners of Mexican music. The first one is going to be Sejo. I know the name, it's a thing. Sejo Hattori or Sejo Hattori. And he has 2 singles that came out last year, and I'm waiting for the fucking album, because it's like, do you remember Gustavo Cerati, the solo shit? You know how much I love it. So the song, for example, Gitana, which is also, it's available everywhere, reminds me so much of her song, of Gustavo Cerati's Bocanada, which is an album from 1999, and I yet to listen to somebody like Cerati, and I think I found it. His name, once again, is Sejo Hattori, and he is produced by Wet Bass, which I've recommended in the podcast like 3 times. And Wet Bass is this kid, I think he's 21 by now, and he's just making smooth, amazing music. So the main person from Wet Bass is the one, the producer of Sejo Hattori. So I went to the webs, and I found this amazing article by our friend Richard from Sangmes. What he was talking about in that article, it's about this movement of kids, especially from places like Chihuahua, that are doing this amazing, amazing acoustic stuff. And he gave us a list of all this folk, like proto-folk, not proto-folk, but like neo-folk artists that are coming out from Mexico. And out of the whole entire list, there was one that totally caught my attention, also from the state of Chihuahua, from the city of Chihuahua. His name is Ed Maverick. And this year he has a new album, and this is a live album. I was like, a live album in El Metropolitan? And El Metropolitan is kind of like, if you... anybody, like any artist, any singer, whatever, if you perform in the Metropolitan, like, ya le hiciste, wey, ya chingaste. So I was like, what the fuck? This guy already has a show in the Metropolitan. And I went back and I started to listen to all his music. Most of it is acoustic. And it is the fucking cutest, most honest, most fucking norteño music you can listen to. Like, I'm not going to say a lot more. Just go and Google Ed Maverick and listen to everything, because his lyrics are so, so, so amazing. And it's part of this bigger movement that is happening. That's why I love Sangmes, and that's why I love Richard, because he always makes me aware, with one artist, he makes me aware that behind that is like a fucking remolino de artistas that are doing all kinds of amazing things. So once again, listen to Ed Maverick, and also listen to Sejo Hattori. Both very romantic, very acoustic, very chill type of music that you will enjoy a lot. And those are my recommendations.
Thank you so much. All right. You got anything else you want to share, Babs?
That's it.
All right. As always, you can visit us at latinoswholunch.com. Send us your emails at asklwlpod@gmail.com. Also, feel free to send us a voice memo. We will air your question also on the next listener letter. So I know a lot of you email, but if you want to talk to us a little bit, and we would love to hear your voices, just keep it under, you know, 5 minutes or 2 minutes. Just keep it, the shorter the better. The shorter your question, the more likely it is to get on the air. And, you know, I'm done with like niceties. If your email is whack, I'm be like, girl, fix this email and send it again, and I will read it. Because some of y'all...
Did you say niceties?
Yes.
I escupí el agua.
Why? You never heard that word before?
I never heard that word. It's so stupid.
You never heard that before?
I thought you made it up. Like, I literally spit my fucking water everywhere.
You need to go outside a little bit. Okay. Just, like, listen, talk to people, maybe watch TV. Maybe watch TV that's not subtitled. Stop watching so much anime.
It sounded so 19th century, but anyway, keep going.
Well, that's my speed, 19th century. So, I forgot where I was. Yeah, send your emails to asklwlpod@gmail.com. And again, thank you so much to all of our Patreon and PayPal fam. Thanks for helping us. But if you cannot donate, because, girl, I've been there, you can help us in other ways. For example, by subscribing and sharing the podcast with your family, with your friends. And also by rating us 5 stars.
5 stars only.
Because the more reviews we have, the more visible we are.
And visibility leads to representation, and representation matters, people.
Today's episode was produced by Emmanuel Ortega and Justin Favela, with production assistance from Maite Sosa. The band you're hearing now is called Brownout. I'm Fabi Fav.
And I'm Babelito.
Bye.
Niceties. Ciao, ciao, ciao.
Stupida.